Hello, welcome back to Tribal Theocrat Live. I'm Christian Gray, and I apologize for the audio problems we've had tonight. Very interesting stuff. But we got it working. We're 20 minutes late. We're going to push on with our guest, and he's on the line right now. Mickey Henry appeared a few months ago to discuss Talmudism, a real fan favorite. Please do download that podcast and listen to it. And tonight he's back to talk about firearms and self-defense and really run the whole gamut on these subjects that are so important to people today. And thank you for coming back again, Mickey.
Oh, well, thank you for having me back on, Christian. I really appreciate it.
And my sincere apologies for the audio problems.
No problem at all.
These things happen, unfortunately. Well, you are the owner of the online bookstore Empty Tomb Books. Tell us about your history with firearms and the battle against gun control.
Well, I was born in the 70s in East Texas, and that area is highly steeped in the gun culture. My dad used to take our family shooting, and I just really took to guns like a duck to water. He was an NRA member, and I religiously read his NRA magazines at a very early age. And I've pretty much been involved with firearms and the pro-gun movement ever since. On two separate occasions in the late 70s, law enforcement officers threatened to murder my entire family because my dad had dirt on them. And I remember him loading every gun in the house and staying up all night. And even though we were just boys, my dad told my brother and me that if he were to become incapacitated, we were to fight on in his stead to defend our mother. Fortunately, though, nothing did come of that, but it left a lasting impression about the need for owning firearms as a power independent of the state. I've been a life member of Gun Owners of America since the late 90s and an annual member for a number of years prior to that. While I don't shoot near as much as I would like to or need to, I do have a fair amount of expertise in the engineering principles of firearms, and I have a lot of interest in the theology of self-defense and weaponry.
I'm so sorry to hear about that scary story as a child.
Yeah, that was something else. He was a high school counselor, and I don't approve of that job role, but he was kind of a father confessor, I guess you could say, to a lot of kids, and they told him about law enforcement involvement in the drug trade.
Sure.
There was another one where a constable was using his daughter kind of as a punching bag, and so it led to some pretty tense situations.
I bet. Well, the big question on everyone's mind is the Second Amendment, and I thought you could give our listeners a little background on the Second Amendment and briefly discuss its meaning.
Sure. The Federalist and the Anti-Federalist were the two parties who publicly debated the adoption of the Constitution. The Federalists were in favor and the Anti-Federalists were opposed. The Bill of Rights was proposed by the Anti-Federalists as a concession required to gain their consent. And even though the Constitution specifically listed the powers of the federal government, the Anti-Federalists wanted additional explicit guarantees restricting its power. Now, it's important to note that the Bill of Rights originally placed no limitations on state governments. In that light, the peculiar wording of the Second Amendment makes more sense. And just as a reminder, the Second Amendment reads, "A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." The well-regulated militia phrase was just repeated from the Articles of Confederation, and it means a well-trained and disciplined group of armed civilians as opposed to a professional standing army, which was forbidden by the Constitution. So it's logically undeniable that this is an individual right because of the definition of what a militia is combined with the phrase right of the people, combined with its context in a document concerning the rights of individuals, and combined with the writings of both the Federalist and Anti-Federalist. But it's stated in light of the need for states both to repel foreign invasion and to maintain a large degree of independence from the federal government, and ultimately to resist the power of the government should it grow, resist the power of the federal government should it grow tyrannical. Now, after the South lost its war for independence during the Reconstruction era, the 14th Amendment was illegally adopted without ever having been legitimately ratified. And this was a revolutionary amendment that destroyed our federal system, and it created a central government with the states as subordinate vassals. It brought into being a propositional idea of a citizen of the United States. Now, prior to that, you would have someone who is a citizen of Georgia or a citizen of Pennsylvania, but no one was a citizen of the United States. But despite the atrocious damage that was done by the 14th Amendment, if we go ahead and assume that that applies, the Second Amendment does now technically apply to the states. So that's really the historical background and meaning.
What about the theological background of the Second Amendment? What ideas about the nature of man led to its formulation?
In order to understand the theological background, we need to realize that the notion of rights and even the notion of a citizen are something we inherited not from Christianity, but from the Enlightenment. Now, don't get me wrong, on a practical level, I'm glad that we have the Second Amendment. But as Christians, our claims to self-defense and firearms ownership are far stronger than constitutional guarantees. To really understand this, we have to go back to Thomas Aquinas in the middle of the 13th century. The foundations of Christian thought properly understood are things like God exists, the Bible is the Word of God, God is infallible, therefore the Bible is infallible, and the Bible tells us that God created man, and therefore man is defined entirely on God's terms. Proper Christianity starts with God and reasons to man, but Aquinas started with man and reasoned to God. And this is just a radical break because it ultimately denies the total dependence of man upon God for meaning. What happened from Aquinas forward was that philosophers would reason until they reached a chasm they couldn't cross, at which point they would insert God as a magic bridge to make their worldview cogent. But over time, this chasm was increasingly reasoned down smaller and smaller, and the magic bridge got shorter and shorter, until all that was left to God was origins. But in 1859, Darwin provided Western philosophy with a non-Christian theory of origins, and that just really opened the floodgates. Now, I have a book in my store that I'd like to recommend to the listeners. It's called The One and the Many by R.J. Rushdie. And about the latter half of that book is all about the history of Western philosophy, but that's available in my store if you'd like it. Getting back to the Enlightenment, the chief tenet of the Enlightenment was man's autonomy, and from there, the supremacy of man's reason, untethered from God's special revelation. The Enlightenment posited a view of man as being independent in a state of nature and having inherent rights. That is, rights simply by virtue of existence, having no reliance on anything external to man. Christianity, on the other hand, presents a view of man as totally dependent on God for meaning. And the best expression of this that you'll find in the Bible is in Acts 17, verses 24 through 28. And I'm just going to read them here. The God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and exist. So God is totally independent, and man is totally dependent. Now, unfortunately, our speech has become so unsanctified that we can't even construct sentences without using the word rights. So what I'm going to do here is offer an alternative definition that we can use and still be faithful to the Christian worldview. If we abstract the idea of a right from its source, a right is simply a claim to do something or to own something. Now, in the Enlightenment view, a right is a claim inherent in man himself to do something or to own something. The Christian version of a right, however, is a claim to do something or to own something based on God's law. In the Enlightenment view of rights, there is no uniform concept of precisely what these natural rights are, and it seems that the only thing that's uniform among natural rights advocates is the right to destroy the existing social order. The Christian view of rights, on the other hand, is very easily definable, and it's simply the mirror image of those things that we are forbidden to do. For example, we have a right to life because thou shalt not kill. We have a right to property because thou shalt not steal. And we have a right to Christian liberty because all those things that are not forbidden to us are permitted. And there's an excellent little 77-page monograph that I want to recommend to everyone here. It's fantastic. It's called What's Wrong with Human Rights? And it was written by T. Robert Ingram. Some benevolent person converted it to PDF, and it's available on the website Contra Mundum.
Sounds like a good recommendation. Let's talk about the theology of the death penalty. It's a subject that I even changed my mind on several years ago, but as a typical evangelical, I approached the issue with some other standard of ethics rather than God's law, and so I was against the death penalty. But it doesn't take too long to do some Christian theology to come to a different opinion on this, and since the justification for our actions must be grounded in God's law and not humanism or some other source, under what circumstances may life be taken lawfully?
Well, the Ten Commandments is a summary of the whole body of God's law. Each of the Ten Commandments is more fully expounded by the case law decisions that are given in Exodus through Deuteronomy. But taking life lawfully falls under the general category of thou shalt not kill. Generally, we may not take another man's life, but the case law expounds the permissible exceptions as well as the proper reaction when this law is violated. The death penalty and self-defense are two circumstances under which law may be lawfully taken. The death penalty and self-defense are kind of linked at the hip. Each has a different goal and motivation, but the occasion and very often the end result are the same. Romans 13 defines for us the proper role of the civil government. It exists to punish crimes. Now, what is crime? Well, sin is any lack of conformity to God's law, and crime is any sin that has a carnal punishment specified for its violation. So Christian penology is retributive. You know, crime is punished in the Christian worldview. This is God's required vengeance when his law is violated, and that's very unlike the penology of the modern messianic God state, which seeks omniscience and omnipotence, claiming to know the hearts of man and to predestine the future through deterrence of future crime, as well as claiming therapeutic and curative powers over the criminal. Scientism holds that crime is basically pathological and seeks to cure it. But in Christianity, we hold that sin is a universal deformity in human nature, the roots of which are found in the fall of man. The death penalty at human hands and all the human government that implies were instituted by God at the fall in order that our task of dominion over the earth might not be thwarted. Now, what was Cain's immediate reaction after God confronted him about murdering Abel? Cain said, "Whoever finds me will kill me." That was his immediate reaction. And it was only by a special dispensation from God that that just punishment was set aside. And after the flood, at the establishment of the Noahic covenant, and which was certainly a pivotal moment in human history, we see that the death penalty was a prominent feature of that covenant. In fact, Genesis 9:6 is a poem about the death penalty. Whoever sheds man's, this is what Genesis 9:6 says, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. And so we very clearly see here that murder is such an affront to God because it is an attack upon the image of God in man. And thus it is clear how utterly apostate modern liberal Christianity is when it argues against the death penalty. They have rejected God and made an idol of human life.
Indeed they have. So that's the death penalty. What about the biblical justification for self-defense? Obviously the magistrate can take life for the death penalty, but what about you and me in a situation of self-defense? Is there a biblical justification for that?
There definitely is, and we have to go to the case law decisions for that, and that would be in Exodus 22:2-3, and that reads, if the thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account. But if the sun has risen on him, there will be blood guiltiness on his account. Now, of course, there's nothing mystical about the sun here. This is just referring to the clearness of a person's intentions. At night, you can't tell if a stranger in your house intends to just steal from you or if he intends to murder you. Therefore, when a criminal's intentions are not clear, but there is a possibility that he intends to kill you, you may kill him without incurring guilt. The case law here deals with the difficult case, and it leaves us the simple case to be directly solved a fortiori. That is, if we may kill a thief when his intentions are not clear, how much more so may we kill a murderer whose intentions are clear? And the Christian doctrine of self-defense also extends to preventing any capital crime against an innocent person. And that would include things like rape and kidnapping. As I mentioned a minute ago, the civil government exacts the death penalty for the sake of retribution after the fact of the crime. The civil government's primary role is not one of deterrence. In distinction to that, deterrence is the role of every Christian man. On some level, all men have a responsibility for enforcing God's law and preventing its violation. The ethic of the death penalty is punishment, but the ethic of self-defense is prevention. Now, an objection to this line of thought is sometimes brought up based on Christ's teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5:38-39 reads, You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. Now, the misinterpretation of this verse is a source of a major Anabaptist error. They reject jus gladii, which is the right of the sword. So, what does this verse mean? I mean, was Christ contradicting his own word? No, of course he wasn't. You know, the Bible contains no contradictions. If our interpretation of a verse results in a contradiction, then it is our interpretation that is in error. Christ's meaning becomes very clear from a bit of history. Lex talionis is the biblical doctrine of an eye for an eye, which simply means that the punishment for a crime must correspond in severity to the crime. The Pharisees of Jesus' time had perverted lex talionis such that revenge, reprisals, and vendettas were the rule of the day, and even the smallest slight or insult was relentlessly pursued. So the proper interpretation of the verse is that Christ is telling us here just to be slow to anger and quick to forgive and not to be so prideful that we can't absorb a minor affront.
That's very good. I'm glad you brought that up. I've been approached with that same issue myself from other people, whether it's white nationalists or just unbelievers, and they wonder why Jesus would teach such a, you know, seemingly passive doctrine of turn the cheek and You know, somebody comes.
I heard your Kenneth Fack on that. That was really good.
Oh yeah,
I
thanks.
I recommend everyone here to listen to it.
Okay, yeah, great. Thank you. That's I think it's called "Was Jesus or Is Christianity Jewish?" There's a FAQ audio on tribaltheocrat.com. And yeah, it's good to make that clarification. Sometimes you wonder why do some people ask the question as if Jesus is teaching. If somebody comes to your door to shoot you and rape your wife, you just say, "Oh, here's my cheek, slap it and come on in." It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. It's absurd.
What about circumstances under which it's lawful to punitively take life?
Typically individuals don't punitively take life, but there is actually one specific condition under which private individuals have that as a lawful power in parallel with the civil government. Punitive killing is a lawful power of the kinsman redeemer. Now, the kinsman redeemer is an extremely important concept in Scripture. There's a reference to it in the oldest book of the Bible, the book of Job, and going in the other direction, you can't possibly understand Revelation chapter 5 unless you know what a kinsman redeemer is and that Jesus Christ is our ultimate kinsman redeemer. Just to define what it is, a kinsman redeemer is your nearest living male relative who is physically or financially capable of performing the responsibilities required of him. The kinsman redeemer is obligated to ransom his relative out of slavery, to redeem the mortgaged inheritance of his relative, to raise up the seed of a deceased brother, to seek justice for his relative, to care for the widows of his family, and, as it's germane to the point here, to avenge the blood of a relative who has been killed. In its normal operation, blood vengeance only occurs after the civil government has declared the killer guilty, but the claim is legitimately the kinsman redeemer's. Now, if the kinsman redeemer were to seek vengeance prior to this determination by the civil government, his claims would have to be investigated, and if they were found true, he would be guiltless. I have one final thought or two along this line, and then we can move on to the next topic. I'm just going to read Proverbs 24:11 here. It says, "Deliver those who are being taken away to death, and those who are staggering to slaughter, oh, hold them back." Now, that could pretty much be a Kenneth motto, and it certainly is a strong command concerning our responsibilities to defend others. But in keeping with that line of thought and in keeping with the kinsman redeemer, in Genesis 14, we read about foreign kings who'd taken Abraham's nephew Lot into captivity. Now, what was Abraham's reaction to that? In Genesis 14 verses 14 through 16, it reads, "When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he led out his trained men, born of his house, 318, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them, and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. He brought back all the goods, and also brought back his relative Lot with his possessions, and also the women and the people." Now, there's no doubt here that Abram was a powerful man, but he was no king. And even though I have seen ridiculous attempts to try to treat him like a king due to his descendants' future claim on the land, but when Lot was carried off by a foreign king, Abram, as Lot's kinsman redeemer, went to war and reclaimed his kinsman and his house. Abraham, as the father of the faithful, gave an example for all of us. And if anybody wants to read more on this, there is an article on Faith and Heritage by Neil Desperandum named Hate the Sin and Hate the Sinner. And he has a section in there entitled Holy Violence, and it's a really good article.
Good. I have not read that article, but as you know, I'm a big fan of Neil Desperandum.
It's quite excellent.
And that's at faithandheritage.com, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Within Christian circles, we often hear about higher authorities, namely that we may only do what the higher authorities allow, and there's often the appeal to Romans 13 about civil magistrates. What is the proper Christian view of authority, Mickey?
Well, first and foremost, let me say that government is a general concept that applies to all spheres of authority. There is government in the civil magistrate, government in the church, government in business, government in families, and on the most basic level, self-government of individuals. It's only a wicked age in which all government is seen as concentrated in the state. In the Christian worldview, all spheres of authority share a common standard of right and wrong, and that is God's law. Each sphere has a unique area of focus, but they all work in a complementary fashion with each other. For example, let's take the law we've been talking about, thou shalt not kill. The civil magistrate puts to death those who violate it. The church proclaims God's truth about it. The family teaches its children to respect and never violate it. And the individual not only controls his own actions, but also defends against violations of this law with force. So all spheres work in harmony under a common law. And since all authority is ultimately the Lord's, all of earthly authority is delegated authority. So a proper view of authority is in a horizontal layout where each sphere is delegated its proper authority directly from the Lord. The Lord gives the civil government its authority, the Lord gives the church its authority, the Lord gives the family its authority, and so forth. So each sphere has a degree of earthly independence from each other, yet a transcendent unity in the Lord. The problem historically is that many have viewed authority more in a vertical layout where the Lord gives all authority to one sphere at the top, which would be either the church or the state, and then all authority for subordinate spheres is delegated to them from the one above. And since the time of Constantine, we've really been fighting that battle of where the church and the state seek to make God so transcendent as to effectively make him irrelevant, such that time becomes determinative over eternity. And the church and the state battle with each other over who is the true immanent expression of God on earth. While most Christians with any degree of orthodoxy are willing to say that we must not obey any command contrary to the law of God, there are sadly few who are willing to resist an order from the church or state that is outside of their proper authority to command it. And that would be an order that's based on nothing but presumption, where they don't really have the legitimate authority to order you to do a particular thing. And I just want to say, you know, this is a very broad overview, and there are special rules in regards to the authority of parents over children. So I don't mean to oversimplify this, but I would also say, too, it's often better to suffer humiliation than to break the peace. And the peace should never be broken over trivial matters. But nevertheless, when the state commands us to do things that it has no basis to command, we may refuse to do so without breaking God's law, though admittedly it's not always easy to live with the consequences of that refusal.
I have started to listen to Alex Jones after he put a smackdown on Piers Morgan on CNN or whatever it was. Don't really listen to him that much, but I have been at work during my lunch hour. I put him on, and he had a caller that called up and said, you know, Alex, I'm a Christian, and I often get laughed at by my Christian friends because I like to go to the shooting range and shoot guns, and I own firearms, and I really like firearms. And they would say to me, why don't you just trust God? Why do you have to have guns to protect you? Why don't you trust God? Why don't you trust God to protect you? And there are actually Christians that do have that view. What would you say to that?
Well, it's getting increasingly that you do hear that even from men, but used to be that was kind of an objection that you heard mainly from the ladies whenever you were trying to convince them to carry a gun. It, it really seems like people are always looking for showy miracles in place of the, you know, often unexciting and ordinary providence of God. If you look in the Bible, though, there were only three periods of time where miracles were commonplace, and that was the time of Moses, the time of Elijah and Elisha, and the time of Jesus and the apostles. Yet, even in the time of Jesus, we see that when King Herod was seeking to kill the infant Christ, God did not miraculously deliver him. Instead, God told Mary and Joseph in a very practical fashion to escape to Egypt. And in the Lord's Prayer, we very humbly request that God give us this day our daily bread. And yet we read in 2 Thessalonians 3:10, if anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either. And further, if we look in Psalm 104, verse 14, the Lord causes the grass to grow for the cattle and vegetation for the labor of man, so that he may bring forth food from the earth. So these things all interact. Now, while God is the ultimate cause of all things, human existence is a realm of valid secondary causes. The Lord providentially provides for us access to weapons for self-defense, and it is sinful for us to pray for miracles when the solution has already been provided. Now, R.J. Rushdoony wrote a great short article on this topic. That's where I got a lot of these ideas from. It was called How Not to Pray, and you can read it on the blog 5-Point Salt.
I really like your point about the miracles in the Bible and how they only happen in specific periods of Scripture, from the Old Testament to the New Testament. Of course, this is not just, for example, when the apostles worked miracles, they're not doing it just to work miracles. They're doing it to help substantiate their claim to apostolic authority. And this is what God did, it seems, during special, either in newer covenants or newer eras, he would use these miracles to authorize that new thing happening, not just willy-nilly, like some Christian denominations teach about miracles. So really good point.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. You can thank Rushdoony for that one.
Rushdoony. That's right, emptytombbooks.com to get your copies of Rushdoony material. Well, we've talked about a Christian view of self-defense and the authority to act, but we haven't talked specifically about weapons, and I would imagine that many people are here tonight to hear about that. In fact, even though we've had some audio problems earlier, my statistics show me we have three times the typical listeners, so that's a good sign.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Sure. Are there classes of weapons that should be outlawed? That's the big question out there today. What do you think?
To answer that question, let me offer a definition of what a Christian weapon is. A Christian weapon is one which, A, permits discrimination between the guilty and the innocent, and B, is operated by the input of a moral agent. So on the first point, nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons have no place in a Christian society because they make no discrimination between the guilty and the innocent, and they should not be owned either by individuals or by the state. And there's a general equity principle at work here with communicable diseases. Such diseases are treated with particular harshness by biblical law. And this is just a classic one-in-the-many problem where the potential danger to society at large becomes the overriding concern. So biblical law deals with this by segregating the sick person from the population. And if their garments or house itself is infected, an effort is made to clean them, but if they can't be cleaned, then they are destroyed. And if anybody wants to read more on that, that's Leviticus chapters 13 and 14. But along that line of thought, if you were to have enough high explosives such that their accidental detonation could destroy your neighbor's house, then it's reasonable for the community to impose safe storage standards on you. On the second point, the decisions to make life must be made by a moral agent. Now, an autonomous drone with killing capability would certainly be an unchristian weapon. And there is at least one device like that in use today with the U.S. military. Now, this is not the, you know, the typical drones are human operated, but there is a specific anti-sniper device they use that's entirely electronic and mechanical. And this isn't some futuristic Terminator thing. It doesn't have to be fancy. You could just have like a simple tripwire operated shotgun where you're trying to use that as an anti-burglary device. That would not be a Christian weapon because it's not operated by a moral agent. So if you're in the world of machine ethics where a device is attacking the image of God and man, then you have a problem. You have a non-Christian weapon. But in distinction to those rules, a man-operated firearm, whether we're talking about a machine gun or a simple shotgun, it does meet the qualifications of a Christian weapon, and it may be owned by an individual without any sort of biblical law restriction.
Excellent. Some are going to require proof texts for the use of weapons. What does the Bible say about specific mentions of weapons? Does it say anything about weapons control?
It does. In the Song of Deborah, in Judges 5:8, it reads, "New gods were chosen, then war was in the gates. Not a shield or spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel." In this verse, disarmament is directly associated with the adoption of false gods. Remember they said, "New gods were chosen." In 1 Samuel 13, verse 19, it makes an interesting mention of Philistine weapons control. It reads, "Now no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears." Matthew Henry, in his Bible commentary, when he commented on this verse, he said, "How slothful and mean-spirited the Israelites were, that they suffered the Philistines thus to impose upon them and had no thought nor spirit to help themselves. If they had not been dispirited, they could not have been disarmed, but it was sin that made them naked to their shame." In Isaiah 2:4 and Micah 4:3, we see the familiar words, "And they will hammer their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn." Now, some people throw that at you as, "Oh, that's a gun control verse." This, though, is a reference to the Messianic Kingdom Age. Now, as a postmillennialist, we know that the kingdom of God on earth was established at the cross in a definitive sense or a positional sense. And even though redemption is an accomplished fact, it is progressively applied in history, finally reaching an ultimate consummation in the future. So this is figurative language for the very real cultural change that we will see as peace is established on the earth. But it really doesn't have anything to do with gun control. In the last two verses that I'll talk about here are a time that occurred immediately prior to the cross. At the Last Supper in Luke 22:36, Christ is speaking to his disciples, and he said, "Whoever has a money belt is to take it along, likewise also a bag. And whoever has no sword is to sell his coat and buy one." Now, this was not a literal command by Christ to purchase weapons, and I would recommend John Gill's commentary for three reasonable alternatives. John Gill's commentary is available on Bible.cc. Just look up Luke 22:36. But what Christ was saying, he was telling them that a time of trouble is coming their way because he was about to be arrested and crucified. Nevertheless, we do see in Christ's words that the ordinary reaction to trouble is to arm oneself. So, in fact, it's a pro-gun verse. It's just not, you know, it's not a command. And finally, we often hear an objection to using weapons for self-defense that was based on an event that occurred immediately thereafter the Last Supper that was in the Garden of Gethsemane. when Christ was betrayed into the hands of the Jews and the Romans, Peter cut off the ear of the slave of the high priest. Now, Christ said in Matthew 26, verse 52 through 54, he said, "Put your sword back into its place, for all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? How then will the scriptures be fulfilled, which say that it must happen this way?" Now, what was happening is Peter was acting presumptively, just like Uzzah studying the Ark of the Covenant. The Son of God was in no need of a man's defense. His messianic mission had to be fulfilled. And Peter was also behaving very rashly by attacking such a superior force and was endangering the lives of all the disciples. The basic meaning that we should take away here is that people who solve all of life's problems with violence are very likely to die a violent death, and that would certainly apply to the U.S. military. There's also, too, though, beyond that, there is a prophetic sense related to the destruction of Jerusalem and the eventual destruction of the Roman Empire, keeping in mind that the Jews and the Romans were there. And there's a few more in the Bible, but I think that's enough to kind of get the overview of it.
That's very good. Last time you were here, we spoke about Jews and Judaism, and on this issue, we know that a lot of major advocates of gun control are Jews, and people are noticing this. Is there anything in their theology that would account for this?
Yes, there certainly is, and there is no doubt about their involvement. If anyone who's involved in the gunfight back in the 80s and early 90s remembers that Howard Metzenbaum was the most hated name in the gun world. And today you have Jews like Frank Lautenberg, Henry Waxman, Charles Schumer, Rahm Emanuel, Michael Bloomberg, Joseph Lieberman, and Dianne Feinstein are relentless anti-gunners. In 1981, the City Council of Morton Grove, Illinois, banned private ownership of handguns, and that actually turned into a huge catalyst for the pro-gun movement. But what no one tells you is that most, if not all, of the city council members of Morton Grove were Jews. Now, why is this? Why are Jews so vehemently anti-gun? And that's a question near and dear to my heart. So I started digging into Jewish sources and discovered that disarmament of Gentiles and of Christians specifically is a halakhic teaching of Judaism. Now, if you remember from anyone who listened to last talk remembers that halakhic just means it's a legally binding rule for Jews. In the Babylonian Talmud, tractate Avodah Zarah, folio 15b reads, "And it has further been taught, one should not sell them either weapons or accessories of weapons, nor should one grind any weapon for them, nor one sell them either stocks or neck chains or ropes or iron chains, neither to idolaters nor Cuthians." Now, any Talmud researcher worth his salt knows that Cuthian is just a deceptive substitute term for a Christian. And this section of the Talmud, Avodah Zarah, is dealing with strange worship or idol worship, which Jews consider Christians to be idol worshipers. Moses Maimonides was the most influential figure in all of rabbinic Judaism, and he wrote a compendium of Jewish law named the Mishneh Torah. In the order of Sefer Nizikim, in section Hilchot Rozniuk, Halakha 12 reads, "It is forbidden to sell Gentiles any weaponry. We may not sharpen weapons for them or sell them a knife, chains to put on the necks of prisoners, fetters, iron chains, raw Indian iron, bears, lions, or any other object that could cause danger to people at large. One may, however, sell them shields, for these serve only the purpose of defense." And then in the same, well, immediately thereafter, Halakha 13, "Just as it is forbidden to sell weaponry to a Gentile, so too is it forbidden to sell it to a Jew who will sell it to a Gentile. It is permitted to sell weapons to the soldiers of the country in which one lives because they defend the Jewish inhabitants of the land. Now, there's yet another reference in the Talmud, and this one is in Tractate Shabbat 63a. Tractate Shabbat contains rules governing Sabbath observance, and it reads, "A man must not go out with a sword, bow, shield, lance, or spear, and if he does go out, he incurs a sin offering. Rabbi Eliezer said they are ornaments for him, but the sages maintain they are merely shameful, for it is said, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." Now keep in mind, as we mentioned a minute ago, that is referring to a condition of the Messianic Age, and the Jews recognize it as a condition of the Messianic Age, but they of course have their own concept of what that is. Jews do not have the same concept of the application of redemption in history that Christians do. They view Gentiles as less than human and view themselves as especially enabled by God to bring about the Messianic Age through the mechanical performance of mitzvot, that is to say, through the performance of Jewish law. So they believe that by performing mitzvot, they metaphysically rebalance the excessive severity in creation by counterbalancing it with mercy. And using the Kabbalistic terms, that would be Gevurah and Hesed. This rebalancing repairs the world and makes manifest the Messianic Age. Now, Tikkun Olam is their phrase for repairing the world. So, by reason of this Talmudic passage, Jews must rid society of weapons in order to bring about the Jewish Messianic Age.
Very, very interesting. Good research there, Mickey, digging into the Talmud to find this justification for Gentile gun control. And if you guys are new listeners and you don't know why the Talmud is important, it is not the Old Testament, which is the authoritative religious text for Judaism. It is the Talmud, and please search our site, tribaltheocrat.com, for Mickey Henry's last interview. Just search for Talmudism or go to the audio archives on his show on Talmudism, and you'll hear it all laid out for you there. Great work. We've picked on the Jews. Let's pick on some Gentiles now. A great many of non-Christian Gentiles, they also seem mesmerized by gun control. Talk a little bit about what motivates their worldview.
Sure. Because man is a creation of God, there are certain categories of thought that are necessary for all men in order to make human experience intelligible. If God is denied, these inescapable concepts are not denied, but instead they find their expression in the mind and activity of autonomous man. The God concept is one such inescapable category. But if the God of the Bible is denied, men will set up for themselves a substitute God. The state, being the most powerful earthly entity, is the most common substitute God. So the God state seeks to be like God and to take on his attributes. It wants to become both omniscient and omnipotent. The omniscient state wants to know everything. Along this line, full registration of all firearms and their owners is an end goal of the omniscient state. It wants to know who all is in your household and whether any of them may meet its own definition of mentally unstable. It wants to know your full history and perform background checks on you. It wants to know how you store your firearms. It wants full traceability of ammunition, and it wants no private sales of firearms because it wants to know. The omnipotent state seeks to be an agency of certainty and control. It wants to predestine the future. Armed men present the state with an uncontrolled variable, a power outside of its control. When attempting to when attempting to solve a problem, the God state only considers solutions that grow its power. Now, further, we know from the Proverbs that all those who hate God love death. The will to self-annihilation is very active in the unbelieving mind. The unbeliever is in denial of his creaturehood, and he is at war with God and all other men. The desire for gun control is often the result of projecting this will to death on gun owners and the fear that they secretly harbor the same desire to destroy mankind. Environmental determinism is also an article of faith for unbelievers. Utopianism is the inevitable end result of that belief. They believe that all men are born equal and thus are all products entirely of their environment. Therefore, if the environment can be perfected, so can man in his society. The unbeliever has an unshakable faith that if just the right gun laws are enacted, a crime-free society will result. And utopianism permits no unsolvable problems. But Christianity presents a very different view of man. Man was created in the perfect environment, but it was man, through sin, who corrupted his environment, and not the other way around. Christianity, as best expressed by Kenism, sees human error as unavoidable, but it works to structure our society in such a way as to limit that error. Now, in addition to these other things, our time has seen the rise of the gynocracy. Women are in power as seldom before, and men have been reduced to sports and video games addicts. The female mind craves security, and it puts its faith in authority figures to reduce uncertainty and therefore to reduce risk. Since husbands are no longer authority figures, women seek a substitute authority figure in the state. And finally, the unbelieving mind is highly subject to manipulation. The mainstream media has become experts at forming a group mind in the population through mental programming. And this is a form of mass hypnotism. Repetition of simple propaganda is a key rule of programming minds. And towards that end, the media has developed a gun control narrative based around punch words. Punch words are terms that trigger automatic response mechanisms in the mind by means of repeated association. For example, the term gun violence is seen repeatedly, and it forms in the manipulable mind the direct association of guns and crime. And other punch words would be gun lobby, assault rifle, gunman, AK-47, cop killer bullet, Glock, high-powered rifle, Saturday night special, and Uzi. So those, you kind of feel your heart jump a little bit when you hear those words because you're so programmed to have that that reaction to them. But I think that generally covers kind of the non-Christian mind and why it's attracted to gun control.
Boy, it wasn't 2 hours after the Sandy Hook tragedy that you had all the major media outlets in sync using the same talking points, talking about mental health issues, talking about gun control, talking about blah, blah, blah. It's amazing what they do to work people up.
Looks like they were on the script.
Yeah, right on the script. It was amazing. Let's get into the guns. Switch gears from theology and talk a little bit about the hardware here. What do you consider to be the Christian man's essential battery?
Well, men generally start out as Christian boys. So probably the best way to answer that is to associate each essential firearm with the age at which a young man should acquire it. Now, they should be trained to use firearms as soon as they're old enough to be able to hold and operate them safely. So what I'm talking about here is boys who have been trained and are ready to start owning their own firearms. And just going at 2-year intervals, at age 8, I would recommend a high-quality break-open single-shot pellet rifle with a spring-operated action. And the gas spring models are the best, and I would recommend a version with a muzzle silencer on it, which is unrestricted if it's permanently attached. He should use the air rifle throughout his whole life for, you know, killing rodents and mainly for training. It's because it's the ultimate and cheap training for trigger skills, how to hold the rifle, your breathing technique, your sighting technique, all of that. At age 10, he should acquire a .22 rifle, and I recommend a Ruger 10/22 semi-automatic or one of the higher-end knockoffs of that rifle. And there's really just nothing more all-around handy than a .22. At age 12, I recommend a 12-gauge pump shotgun, and buy two barrels, get an 18-inch barrel for home defense, and a longer barrel for bird hunting. Start him off with some of the low recoil loads that are commonly available. You don't want him punched too hard in the shoulder, so give him those low recoil loads. A Mossberg 500 or a Remington 870 would both be good choices. At age 14, I suggest a full-size semi-automatic 9mm pistol, and I would recommend a polymer-framed striker-fired model such as either the Steyr M9, the Carico, the Walther PPQ, the Springfield XD or XDM, a Smith & Wesson M&P, or a Glock. Finally, at age 16, he should acquire a semi-automatic defensive rifle, and I recommend either a SIG 5.56 or an AR-15. So whatever he chooses for a rifle, though, it's essential that it be in 5.56 by 45 and that it accept AR-15 magazines. So that should really get him kind of the essential battery and, you know, acquire some more from there.
It's good information. I picked up a used shotgun a couple weeks ago and got it from my dad because he doesn't have a shotgun. It's got a long barrel on it, so you mentioned that for personal defense you probably want a short barrel. You think he'll have any problems, though, with that long barrel?
The main problem with a long barrel is whenever if you're trying to use it inside your house, it's very easy for the criminal to grab the end of the barrel and overpower you. So I generally prefer, you know, a short barrel like that. And also, too, just being able to go through halls and doorways and such, it's best if you have a short one. But that's not to say a long one that you can't defend yourself with. You certainly can.
Right. Yep, it'll still save your life, won't it?
Absolutely.
How about recommendations for a man who's new to all this and would like to purchase his very first firearm? Do you have any recommendations for the very first firearm for a guy?
Yeah, I would say for grown men, it's essential first and foremost that they carry a pistol at all times. So if you live in an open carry state, you know, where you can carry a firearm in the open, buy one of the full-size 9mm pistols that I recommended. But if you live in a state where only concealed carry is lawful, then get a small 9mm automatic, semi-automatic. And for that, I would recommend either a Beretta Nano or the just released Springfield XDS in 9mm. Now, there was a Springfield XDS in .45. The 9mm was just released at the SHOT Show, and that's the one I'd go with.
Now, the Nano. Go ahead. I was going to say the Nano.
I would get a 12-gauge pump shotgun, and then from that point on, it really doesn't matter what order you go in.
Okay. I saw an ad for the Beretta Nano in, I think, Guns and Ammo magazine. Is that a new release for Beretta? Or has that been around for a while?
I think it's been out for at least a year.
Okay.
And maybe a year and a half or two, something like that. But it's so narrow is what's very nice about it.
Okay.
And even like the slide release is internal, so you're not going to snag it on your clothes if you had to draw it real quickly. So it's a nice little pistol.
Yeah. We know that men are the primary defenders of the home, but since so few men actually work at home, women must defend for themselves at least part of the time. So what weapons do you recommend for women?
Well, it definitely needs to be a handgun they can put in their purse. Now, women have very different needs than men, and I highly recommend that husbands don't try to indirectly add to their collection through their wife. It really needs to be her gun. Women place a higher value on aesthetics than function, so it needs to be something they choose for themselves, but with input and direction from either their father or their husband. A woman won't carry a gun that she thinks is ugly, so limit the choices for them, but let them make the final decision. Unlike men, women get no thrill out of recoil or noise or mechanical complexity. If they dislike the recoil or fear that they may accidentally set off the gun by misoperating a lever or a button, you're going to find that handgun hidden in a drawer somewhere rather than being in their purse. As a general rule, women do not like semi-automatic pistols. There's just too much knowledge required to operate them successfully, and they're just not that interested in it, which, that's okay. They're nurturers. Most women are happiest with a small-framed .38 Special revolver, and Smith & Wesson even has a line they call the Lady Smith, and if she can handle the greater recoil from a light handgun, I would recommend that she go with an aluminum frame model. If not, go ahead and get a stainless steel. It's going to be a little heavier to carry around, but the recoil will be less. And I recommend a shrouded hammer model, but those can look a little ugly, so if she thinks it's too ugly, then go with a hidden hammer model. And that's to keep, you don't want an exposed hammer that's catching on things in her purse. And I would recommend that you definitely stick with a Smith & Wesson.
Now, are those double action all the time?
Yes. The hidden hammer model is double action all the time.
Yeah.
The shrouded hammer model, it actually exposed the hammer spur, but it has kind of a shroud over the sweep of
okay.
the hammer. So you can still single action it, but it keeps the hammer from hooking or anything.
Got it. Probably a good idea for the wife to practice it, since it is double action, you got a longer trigger pull.
Definitely.
Well, nobody really wants to get into a gunfight, and we have guns so that we can use them when we need to, but perhaps it's best to pray that we never have to use them in this situation. While it's important that we be willing and able to defend ourselves, what are some tactics we can use to avoid getting into gunfights?
Well, we always hear that the first rule of gunfighting is bring a gun, but actually that's the second rule. The real first rule of gunfighting is don't get into gunfights. The easiest way to stay out of a gunfight is simply to avoid places where they are likely to occur, and that generally means avoiding places where blacks are likely to congregate. Secondary to that, it also means avoiding Mexicans and white trash. The general idea is to avoid provoking envy. Now, envy is not the same thing as jealousy. The envious man seeks the destruction of the object of his envy and not its transfer to his possession. The object of his envy may be a person, a race, or anything he views as possessing an advantage that he does not have and cannot have. If he can't have it, then he finds it intolerable that anyone else can have it either, and so he seeks to destroy it. Now, tangible things are certainly able to provoke envy, but so can intangible things like beauty, intelligence, a more excellent reputation, or greater self-control. So know the minority areas of your town and stay out of them. If you're traveling, fill up your fuel tank before entering urban areas and stay on the freeway unless you can tell that you are in a white part of town. If you absolutely must enter a minority area, if you know someone of that race who will escort you and you trust them, then ask them to do so. But if you cannot find a person of that race to escort you, then make sure that you only travel in a group. And ladies, always have a man around. Around black men, any unescorted white lady is at high risk of being raped or at the very least mercilessly harassed. do not drive nice vehicles in minority areas of town. Don't wear nice clothing or watches. And ladies should dress very modestly with their hair pulled back in a simple ponytail. And our ladies need to realize how much their beautiful hair provokes envy in the other races. And if you're going to be around them, you need to cover your hair with a simple kerchief, and that especially is true if you're blonde. And if you do have to drive through black areas of town, try to do so early in the morning, because most of the troublemakers don't get up before like 10:30. Stay out of fried chicken restaurants, Chuck E. Cheese, IHOP, Denny's, McDonald's, and taquerias. Stay out of convenience stores. Any business that sells beer, candy, cigarettes, and lottery tickets is a magnet for the wrong kind of people.
Yep.
And any store that is within easy walking distance of low-rent apartments or Section 8 housing should be avoided. Stay off public transportation at all costs. And don't go into any stores near a bus stop. Also, and this is specific to each state, but learn the day of the month that SNAP and welfare EBT cards are funded and stay out of the stores on those days. Keep a free entertainment event, especially if there is free food or candy, is very likely to be overrun by minorities. So you need to avoid those events like the plague. There's a good book that I would recommend the listeners to read. It's by Helmut Scheck, and it's called Envy, A Theory of Social Behavior. It's not a explicitly Christian book. It's more libertarian, but libertarians often get the why. I'm sorry, get the what correct, but they don't get the why, but it's a great book.
We just lost a couple of listeners. somebody might be tuning in and hear you saying, hey, avoid blacks, but this stuff is backed up by the FBI crime statistics. It's just an objective, empirical, eyeball evidence stance. It's we know that there's actually a PDF out there available online called The Color of Crime, and the best indicator of crime happens to be race. So I appreciate you making these points.
We're not trying to bring down shame on any decent Christian black folks. It's just, you know, this is the reality that we're faced with.
Yeah, and there are black men who will repeat what we're saying. We're trying to save our lives here, not be politically correct. So good information, Mickey. Well, if we do, sorry, the fried chicken comment really got me. If we do have to be around minorities, what are some tips we can use to minimize the potential for conflict or to win the fight if it comes to that?
Well, Solzhenitsyn observed that when universal standards of morality are rejected, all that's left is manipulation. First and foremost, it is important to realize that other races don't think just like us. With blacks, the most critical thing to know is that they only respect force. Never, ever show weakness to blacks. It may seem counterintuitive, but the only thing that will keep you out of a fight with blacks is the open and sincere willingness to fight them. Further, realize that if they have begun an attack on you, any weakness you show can easily trip their fight or flight mechanism. And the fight part of the mechanism. They just get a total leave of their senses, and they do horrible things all out of proportion to anything resembling human behavior. And I would recommend that folks read Justin Cottrell's Rise of the Black Serial Killer. And he talks about the phenomenon of overkill. It's an excellent book. I carry it in my store now. And I've got a great price on it, a better price than Amazon. I highly recommend it to anyone listening. Also, blacks are superb at intimidation. They are excellent actors, and they'll get in your face and they're going to snarl about all the awful things that they're going to do to you. But you need to realize, and this is something I learned growing up in the South, realize that they're just testing the waters to see who the real alpha is. If you cower, they smell weakness and will attack. An appropriate response whenever they do this, it's simply to say, well, bring it on. I'm ready anytime you are. But whatever you do, don't insult their mothers and don't call them a nigger. These things Republicans act like triggers to provoke violent behavior. They know that any white who uses racial slurs against them has basically given up equal protection of the law. Realize, too, that blacks are not very good at abstract reasoning, and thus they are deficient at consequential thinking. So help them out with visualizing the consequences of their actions. Tell them they'll go to prison where they won't be able to have a woman, or drink beer or smoke weed. And play on their fears, too. Blacks have a very superstitious view of the world and think that whites have some magic power that explains our technological prowess. They are also highly subject to suggestion. So you can say things like, "You may kill me, but we have ways of finding out who you are. Just look at how many blacks are in prison." And that's something, you know, I mean, variations on that theme. Now, in addition to Rise of the Black Serial Killer, I also recommend that everyone read Gedalia Braun's article, Morality and Abstract Thinking. If you just search on Google, Gedalia Braun, Morality and Abstract Thinking, it'll come up. There's one, I think, on White Locust, one, and it was originally, I think, published by American Renaissance. Also, no Kentish library is complete without Kent Stefkin's The Bondage of the Free. And that book has many excellent racial realist observations about black folks. And it's, you know, it's not something that's attacking black folks. Like here, we're not attacking all black folks. We're just trying to say, if you have a black person who's attacking you, here's a way you can manipulate them to try to get out of it. Now, switching the topic to Mexicans, it's important to know that they think very differently than blacks. With one exception, they do have a very high view of their mothers, so do not insult a Mexican's mother. One of the most important things to know about Mexicans is that they value their family and their friends above all abstract moral principles. So I guarantee you, if you get into a fight with one Mexican in a group, you will have to fight the entire group. But if you're on friendly terms with a Mexican that they may know, then definitely tell them that, because they're not going to jeopardize that relationship by fighting you. Further, they do strictly observe rules of hospitality due to their Indian background. So if they say, "Hey, gringo, what you doing in my part of town?" you can tell them, "Oh, you know, I was invited to, you know, Juan Hernandez's house," or, you know, something like that. Now, the second most important thing to know about Mexicans is that they are a face culture, in much the same respect as the Orient. So do not say things to them that would require them to fight you in order to keep from losing face. Also, they are attuned to helping others from losing face, so you can play on that. Show them differential respect. Say something like, "I realize you have the right to control your own home area, and I apologize for the intrusion, and if you'll let me leave, I will be in your debt. My mother would be very sad if she lost her only son." So you're kind of playing on that maternal relationship there that they have. So you're trying to make it of where you're showing respect to them, you're not causing them to lose face, and you're giving them the opportunity to let you save face. There's a book I will recommend to the users. Now, this thing is PC is all get out. I mean, it's got bad stuff in it, but it has a lot of useful information. Written by a man named John Condon, and it's Good Neighbors Communicating with the Mexicans.
Sounds good. Good, really good advice there. We have a question from a lady in the chat room who says, if females are approached in a harassing manner by a minority, is there certain behavior that they can use to de-escalate?
That, you know, I thought long and hard about that, and it's really, you're just in a very bad situation.
Yeah.
If you are a female especially by yourself, and you're surrounded by blacks. And I mean, I saw it all the time in high school, where, you know, something like, "Hey, baby, find yourself over here and talk to me a little bit." And the woman would say, I'm not interested in, "Well, you waitress or something?"
Right.
You know, you need to prepare a response to that because you're going to hear it. My only recommendation is just try to be as absolutely ladylike as possible and hope that there is some decency remaining in them, and we'll let you go. But basically, they carry your revolver and be ready to use it. I wish I had some good advice for you, but boy, it's difficult to de-escalate that. Not that anybody listening to this broadcast would, but never do anything that would be interpreted as flirtatious.
Right.
Don't smile at them. Don't initiate contact. Don't initiate the beating. That's something in the South. If a woman initiates a beating, we assume that she's interested in it.
Sure.
So you definitely don't want to do that kind of thing with blacks. Sorry, I wish I had something to say. That's about it much about what I can come up
yeah,
with.
Yeah, no, it's okay. It's a hard situation to overcome. I think it's another argument for women being reserved and staying home as much as possible. When you do go out, make sure you have a man with you. And fathers and husbands need to really think about what's going on when they send their women, their ladies out, 9 to 5 and so forth, especially in urban areas. It's not something I think is ethical at all. If we do end up having to use our firearms in self-defense, do you have any guidance for actual steps we should take to win that fight?
Well, the first thing we always need is situational awareness. And any time that I go into a public place, I scope out the exits and I make a mental note of any potential threats. If I see anyone questionable, I keep an eye on them and I mentally formulate a plan to react to any threat that they offer. Now, if you read the literature on this, one observation concerning gunfights is that the man who initiates them is most often the one who wins them. And that's because the person being attacked is having to orient himself and determine a course of action. All the while, the initiator has already done that. So if you are aware of potential threats and already have a course of action in mind, you significantly reduce your reaction time. One of the most important things to winning a gunfight is just, this may sound crazy, but just simply accept the worst possible outcome. Conceive of what it is. If you can accept it, then you're kind of unstoppable because, a man who's willing to die is going to be very difficult to stop. Never, ever gamble your life in hopes that a criminal will show mercy to you if you just comply with his demands. Further, if you are shot, don't be surprised. It's a gunfight. Just keep fighting and make your enemy pay for every inch of ground. Now, we said before that the first rule of gunfighting is jump into gunfights, and the second rule is bring a gun. The third rule of gunfighting is bring a flashlight. Most criminal attacks occur under cover of darkness, and having a light can mean the difference between life and death. If you can afford it, purchase a weapon-mounted light for all of your defensive weapons, including your bedside handgun. Another observation about gunfights that, from reading the literature on this, and logically, distance favors the trained man. So if you are trained and you have a lot of distance between you and an attacker, it's more likely that you're going to win. An easy way to defeat an enemy is if you're outside of his maximum effective range, but he's inside of yours. So, any hits that he delivers on you are just going to be luck, but you can attack him based on your skill. Most police train with handguns to a maximum distance of 25 yards, and the U.S. military trains with rifles for a maximum engagement distance of 300 meters. Now, in Afghanistan, and just to let anyone listening know, I do not support that war, but in Afghanistan, the combatants over there, they knew that the military trained to 300 yards, so they positioned themselves at high points about 400 to 500 meters away. And, they were basically the military that called an airstrike on them to take them out. Also, this is a topic that is very seldom discussed, and that's preserving your hearing in a defensive shooting situation. if you ever fire a gun without earplugs while you're in a confined space, you're not going to go deaf, but you will experience permanent hearing degradation. There are several ways, though, to either prevent or limit the damage. First, if you have the time to put them in, there are earplugs you can get that allow you to hear normal sounds, but they significantly reduce impulse noise. For defensive firearm use indoors, do not use a rifle. Don't use a 357 Magnum. Those things are very loud. Don't use a pistol with a corded barrel or a muzzle compensator. And keep all of your short-barreled pistols for concealed carry use. So definitely keep a full, I would recommend a full-size pistol for your home, you know, your bedside home defense pistol. A low-pressure round like the 9mm or 45 is certainly preferable. And always use subsonic rounds because the sonic boom is really quite loud. And finally, this is something that very interesting, or I thought it was, that noise-induced hearing loss is actually due to the creation of free radicals. So taking an antioxidant like vitamin K as soon as you can after the event will help save your hearing. And you can also do a technique called grounding, and folks can look that up on alternative health sites. Before moving on to the next topic, I should probably say a word or two about the bullet's effect on the human body, and that's known as terminal ballistics. There are a lot of bad theories on that topic, and people are forever trying to numerically quantify with a single number the so-called stopping power of a particular round using some pet formula. But basically, that's an empirical science, and you can't really do it formulaically. Basically, there is no substitute for massive tissue damage with a large entry and exit wound. There is no such thing as a one-stop shot unless you hit the man in the central nervous system. Typically, the most immediate thing that stops people is just blood loss. They eventually pass out. And so you need those holes going in and out to drain the blood. Most tissue damage is not caused by energy or by velocity. It's just simply the blunt impact of the bullet. Many have made a god out of energy and velocity, but all you really need is enough velocity to get the bullet to penetrate about 12 inches, so that even if you shoot at them through the side of their chest, it'll still reach the middle of the thoracic cavity. And on this one, I know, you know, all the 9mm haters are going to hate, but, you know, guess what? A 9mm does that just fine. A 9mm is a perfectly fine defensive round. And I think that's about all I got on that.
Really good information. Nice, fresh stuff on preserving your hearing. I've never thought about that. And I have to get some vitamin K. Hopefully I'll never use it for that situation.
It actually, you know, has a prophylactic effect if you take it. You know, if you just normally take it, it will help you if you have that sort of injury. It's not, you don't have to take it after it. You can take it before.
Right. Regarding the terminal ballistics, there's a good YouTube series from Masad Ayoub on. You can search for Masad Ayoub, A-Y-O-O-B, and he talks about the cartridge. You know, everyone wants to know what's the best cartridge to use to kill someone, and he gives a lot of considerations, including the constitution of the person you're shooting. Is he an aggressive person? Is he a pussy? and he says that these are a lot of factors that go into whether you can just knock someone down with one round, including the person's temperament. So I recommend that YouTube series.
Okay.
Concerning distance, could you give our listeners a little guidance related to maximum engagement distances?
Yes. First of all, there's skill-limited engagement distance, and that's when you're shooting at a person, you're not trying to hit them in the center of mass. That's what you always hear, center of mass. But what you're really trying to hit them is in the thoracic cavity. And that's an area about the size of a dinner plate below a person's neck. So whatever range you can consistently hit a dinner plate is your maximum skill-limited engagement distance. Now, firearm selection also places technical limits on range. As a projectile travels, it's acted on by a number of forces, one of which is gravity. And so eventually, you know, all projectiles are going to hit the dirt. Further, while a projectile can travel at distances, they really cease to be effective killers at some distance from the muzzle. And that's because there's a constant drag on the projectile as it moves through the air. And at extreme distances, it's only going to bruise a person. So really, the real question here is not what the maximum range is, but what the maximum range is such that the projectile can still do significant damage. The actual maximum effective range depends on a lot of factors, so I'm only going to be able to give general guidance here. For a pistol, 25 yards is the typical maximum range, but with careful aiming, you can extend that to 50 yards. And, a bullet at a pistol bullet at 100 yards is still going to do a lot of damage. It's just trying to get it on targets. It's going to be difficult. For a shotgun, the maximum effective range of 12-gauge buckshot is about 40 yards. But within that range, the 12-gauge buckshot is about the most effective self-defense round that there is, because it has multiple large pellets that does a lot of tissue damage and it leaves a lot of holes for blood to drain out. Using slugs in your shotgun will increase the effective range to about 100 yards, but you really have to aim carefully to do that. A rifle barrel and a better projectile can extend that range. I'm talking about a rifled shotgun barrel. With a better projectile, can extend that range to about 150 yards, and it also greatly improves your accuracy at shorter ranges. For a 5.56 rifle, as we previously mentioned, the typical military engagement distance is 300 meters, and that's about 3 football fields end to end. However, if you use the right ammunition, like a Mark 262 77 grain rounds, you can extend the maximum of engagement distance to about 600 meters. But to use a heavy bullet like that, you need a 1-7 or a 1-8 twist barrel. I suggest that you find a local football field, because that's the most normal place where you see something measured off, and just walk it until you get kind of intuitive feel for estimating distance and, you know, figure out whether or not you can engage somebody at a particular distance by reckoning the distance.
You mentioned buckshot as the ideal shotgun round for personal defense. I don't have a lot of that, but I picked up a lot of cheap, not cheap, but just inexpensive target rounds. Is that going to be effective for a situation?
It would depend on the choke you're using, but okay. If you used a full choke, you could get about the same range out of it. You could still go about 40 yards.
Well, are you really looking for range, though, with a shotgun in your home?
No, you're generally not. I mean, yeah. If I'm inside my home, I'm actually going to be using my handgun, not my shotgun.
Okay.
If I have to go out in my, you know, like let's say that you're in a rural area, and you go out in the yard, you see somebody out there, that's the kind of circumstance I'm talking about.
Okay.
But if you're inside the house, you know, yeah, birdshot will, you know, that'll get an end too.
Yeah.
No problem.
Okay, good. This is really good information. Well, let's talk a little bit about political action. That's been in the news for 5-6 weeks. Now, we often hear that we should write to your congressman, write to your senator about pending gun control legislation. Do you think this is even worthwhile?
The answer is sometimes. First, just let me say that as Canist, we're working for a real organic shift in our society. And that sort of shift only occurs at the level of individuals and families and churches. Only a power religionist seeks to transform society through politics. Our primary responsibility, after our responsibility to God, is to our own family. And I've seen far too many men or women who get on a messianic ego trip, and they go work tirelessly to try to reform the state, but they totally ignore and destroy their own family while they're doing it. Nevertheless, though, subservient to Christ, it is our position as Christians to both own and rule the earth. We're not to cede any territory to unbelievers. So political action is very much something that we can and should do But our actions should always be tempered by the knowledge that people usually get the government they deserve. A commonly held belief in a populace very often finds its expression in law, and that's a pretty hard thing to fight against. What isn't nearly hard to fight against, though, is, and the thing that we should really throw our weight behind, is when law is being used in a revolutionary way to transform society. And things also get really interesting when the population is highly polarized, like they are right now on the gun control issue. And it kind of becomes a war of wills as to who wants it more. So yes, political action can be worthwhile, but don't make it your life's calling. And always try to use your time and resources where you are the most effective. Now, along that line of thought, if you're in one of the few districts where you have a real radical for your congressman, then don't waste your time writing them. You know, spend that time on more productive pursuits. But I'll tell you, too, that I have met several congressmen, and I can honestly tell you that I was amazed at their level of stupidity. The only thing that they were really good at was pressing the flesh, and they're really just the ultimate opportunist, and they'll take whatever action that they think benefits them. They're not principle-driven in the sense of our kind of principles. The principle that drives them is me. You know, what's best for me. So if your congressman is one of those, and about 90% of them are, then writing them can have an effect on swaying their vote if they think it's going to cost them. So, yeah, it requires some wisdom to know whether or not it's worth time or not.
We are at 93 minutes. So are you okay to press on and finish up?
I am. I think we're pretty close.
Excellent. I really appreciate it. I don't know all of the different pro-gun organizations. I know the main two. So give our listeners a brief rundown of the national pro-gun organizations that you're familiar with.
Yeah, there's a lot of them out there, so I'm only going to mention some of the top ones. Everyone, of course, knows about the National Rifle Association, and they're certainly the largest. But, you know, while the media loves to use them as a whipping boy, I also have some fairly major differences with them, but it's obviously for very different reasons than what the media has. They are classic power religionists, and as such believe that strength is found only in numbers. They do not understand that strength comes from consistent faithfulness to principle, and they will compromise if they think it will serve their ends. The NRA plays the role that has been assigned to them, but they're utterly unaware of what that role is. That role is really best explained in terms of Hegelian dialectics. What happens time and again is that anti-gun forces propose a new law to restrict or eliminate some class of firearms. That's the thesis. The average gun owner reacts to that and demands that no new laws be created. That's the antithesis. The NRA, having no principle other than success, fears a total failure if they don't offer a compromise. So the compromise will put new restrictions in place, but it won't be as severe as what was originally proposed. So that's the synthesis. The NRA is constantly creating the synthesis. Everyone plays their role in that, and of course the left is going to scream about the nasty NRA, but you see, it's actually the left who's driving the agenda. And I also say, too, that the NRA constantly supports not the best political candidate, but the candidate with the best chance of winning. They love to win. And they have the classic single issue syndrome, where it's the only issue they're interested in. I remember seeing an article in their magazine, The American Rifleman, where they were saying how the pro-gun position is pro-feminist, and isn't that wonderful? And as with so many conservatives, they just whore after classes of people who will never side with them. The next organization I'll talk about is Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. This organization has a hidden agenda that they constantly push, and they have been very successful. Now, even Tom Hengist covered some of that on the earlier show, so I won't go over the same ground. But basically, their secret agenda is to form in the minds of gun owners an association between anti-gunners, Nazis, and white Southerners of the Jim Crow era, while building a mythos around the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. That's the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, not the Warsaw the goal is to form a positive association between guns and Jews that is really contrary to reality. Anytime you bring up the facts that the ranks of anti-gun organizations are top-heavy with Jews, you always have to hear, yeah, but what about JPFO? Yeah, but what about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising? So they've been very effective in pushing this hidden cultural Marxist agenda. Next, I'll mention the Second Amendment Foundation and the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. These organizations also have a hidden agenda, but it's a pretty straightforward one. It's to fleece gun owners and line in Alan Gottlieb's pockets. Alan Gottlieb is himself a Jew, and while I do think he's a sincere libertarian, this guy just pops out new organizations like a Pez dispenser, and from what I can tell, they really serve a positive purpose. His organization only accomplishes just enough to keep dangling the carrot. The last one I'll mention is Gun Owners of America, and it's the best of the nationals, though I can only say that they're the least objectionable. My family and I once ate dinner with Larry Pratt in the Fellowship Hall of a Presbyterian church. There was a pro-South conference being held there, and we got to talk with him a good bit. He's the founder of Gun Owners of America, and he's a good man. He's actually a longtime ruling elder of a PCA Presbyterian church up in Virginia. My main criticism, though, of GOA is that you really have to put up with all of the glory boy worship and the fretting about terrorists, you know, all the jingoistic crap that's part and parcel of American conservatism. And GOA has bought hook, line, and sinker the mythos that's been generated by JPFO. On the GOA blog the other day, on MLK Day, I saw that they were basically saying that, oh, MLK was pro-gun, but mean Southern Whitey didn't want him to have one.
Yeah, I saw that too. That was disgusting.
It was just disgusting. Pratt, though, I will say in his defense, he's the only national figure I remember that supported the militia movement back in the days after Ruby Ridge and Waco. And finally, I would say that there are a number of state and local groups that are worth looking into. And for example, I understand the Iowa Gun Owners is quite good. So join up if you're in Iowa.
Sounds great. We've talked about problems. Let's talk about solutions now. I always ask my guests to give some solutions to our problems. First, let's assume that we had the power to fully implement our own agenda. What would you do to lessen violence in our society?
The biblical blueprint for society is men living in extended family groups. And those extended family groups are what we normally call race. Modern man has rebelled against this biblical blueprint, and it's had disastrous consequences. The bulk of the conflict in our society is due to a mixture of unharmonious religions, cultures, and races. In regards to violence specifically, blacks are the chief cause. Therefore, we must begin taking steps to return back to the biblical blueprint. The first step would be to overturn the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and all subsequent enactments, and that would restore freedom of association and lawful use of private property. This would permit a natural de facto segregation to reassert itself. Eventually, we should begin a soft repatriation of blacks to Africa or the creation of a black homeland within the borders of the United States. And by soft repatriation, I mean that it would be voluntary for any black who wanted to do so. You know, we would fund him to do it. But it would be mandatory only for blacks who violated some pre-established standard, say, for example, if they were a repeat criminal or if they had more than two bastard children. Now, the second largest cause of violence in our society is the war on drugs. So we should immediately decriminalize the manufacture, possession, and use of drugs while keeping solicitation and advertising for drugs illegal, as well as being high in public. The third major contribution to violence is government schools. We should just shut them down immediately. This is the chief institution Amen. In our society where children are taught that everything is ultimately meaningless. This is because the denial of God is the denial of meaning. Government schools inculcate in children the will to self-annihilation. The fourth major contribution to violence is a monopoly of force in the hands of law enforcement agencies. And on this topic, I recommend that everyone listen to the two interviews that you did with Robert Fingolfin. Those were excellent. We should immediately make it legal and take steps to encourage universal open carry of firearms by all Christian men. This would drastically reduce crime through deterrence, and by being an open display and reminder of the dominion of Christians over God's creation through the power of the death penalty. Finally, make abortion illegal and end the warfare state, because when murder is institutionalized, life is made cheap.
Amen, amen, and amen.
Thank you.
Excellent. We need to hear that over and over again. I mentioned it on our last show with Scott Terry and Matthew Heimbach. I can't believe there's people out there who are now all of a sudden anti-state. Don't take my guns, but they got no problem giving them the kids.
I know.
It's amazing. Oh, wow. It makes my blood boil, but great point. Since we obviously don't have the power at this point to implement those solutions you mentioned, Mickey, what do you recommend that we do right now when people stop this broadcast, and what do they do tomorrow?
Well, first and foremost, if you haven't removed your children from government schools, then get them out now. I mean, right now. And secondly, if it is legal for you to own a firearm and you don't have one, then you need to man up and buy one. Or if you're a woman, you don't have to man up, but just buy one. if it's legal for you to open carry a firearm, and you can do so without going to jail for disturbing the peace, then all is open carry. If you can't do that, but it's legal for you to carry a firearm concealed, then carry one at all times. Train your children in the safe, proper use and enjoyment of firearms, and join the fight against gun control through GLA or a state or local organization. If you see a business that does not permit open or concealed carry, go in, ask to speak to the owner, and tell them that they will not be getting the business. If you're in a position of leadership in your church, encourage all men in the church to carry firearms. And when arguing the program case with others, don't use the enemy's rhetoric or argument. Drop gunmen and gun violence from your vocabulary. Don't base your argument in favor of semi-automatic firearms by arguing against fully automatic machine guns. And do not base your arguments on sporting purposes. Be clear. This is talking about taking life in accordance with God's law. And finally, keep your situational awareness high at all times and stay out of black and Mexican areas.
Such good advice. I want to throw one last question on you, and it's a surprise bonus question, because I get this question a lot, and I know a lot of people who are listening who are firearms guys. They want to know what's the answer to this. If you don't want to answer, that's okay. I have my own take on this. The place of employment that we go to every day, oftentimes they have a rule that says you can bring a firearm, keep it in the parking lot in your car, don't bring it in the building. Yet that doesn't help us, because we're going to get shot up inside the building. What is there any wisdom here that you can offer?
I have the exact same situation at work, and I carry a pistol inside every day.
Yep.
So that's my answer to it. I mean, and I understand too. I mean, if you got metal detectors or something you got to go through, you just can't do it. But if you can get away with it, I'm less concerned with their ability to control their private property than I am with my ability to defend my life and the life of other people there. So,
good.
I mean, it requires some wisdom on it. It's just like I do not have, you know, an absolutized view of private property. And I think, you know, Tom made some good points about that in his talk. So that would be my advice. Carry if you can.
I agree. Because at the end of the day, dead is dead and alive is alive.
And, absolutely.
I always carry, never tell. And as someone has said, sometimes it's easier to ask for forgiveness than it is for permission.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show again. Very intelligent show, very witty and sometimes funny. This is going to be a good podcast, and I'll try to wrap that up and put it on theocrat.com for people to download and listen to. And anytime you ever want to come back, the invite is always there for you.
Oh, thank you.
And join us on the February 16th for Robert Finkelfin, because we're going to have him on once again to talk about more police state, law enforcement issues, and probably some boy military stuff, too. Thanks a lot, everybody. I'm Christian Gray. We'll see you next time.